Right, good afternoon. Are there questions? Yes, yeah, they have more than one. And we'll see an answer, we will see once we go a few weeks on in group into group theory, we will actually see an answer that one can calculate it, but we don't yet know how to. Okay. But yes, there are many. In the first problem, there are several primitive roots. This isn't unique. Okay, what I wanted to do now is to show you an example where one actually crucially uses rings and quotient rings to do something practical, and that is error correction. Since this is something which isn't really done in our book, I made a handout. Please pass this around. I very cleverly thought I photocopy on double-sided and pressed the wrong button, and so this my single-sided source got copied double-sided, so the backs also are photocopies of the empty pages on the back. Anyhow. All right, so I talked already in last lecture about the reasons for doing error correction, and some of the basic ideas. We don't just want to do things redundantly. So now let's look actually at in more detail about what one can do and how one can do this. So I will assume that I have a message, and since this is not a course about how to build a phone or so, I really assume that I have the message already given as some elements. Typically, they will end up as elements of a finite field. So I have a message A1, A2, and so forth, up to AK. Okay, where these are all elements in some field. For example, if you look at digital transmission, you might say you want to choose the field with two elements because that's convenient. That corresponds to ones and zeros. Or you could take the field with four elements, and then every element would correspond to a pair of ones, zeros, for example. So that's the message. Of course, our message overall could be longer than K symbols. Well, if it is longer, we just repeat this. So in some way, this is just a chunk of the message. This might just be part of a word or some words or so. If the message overall is longer, we just repeat things. And we do exactly the same again. So that's what I'm not looking at. Okay. And what I want to do from this, basically, the idea is I now do something which is called encoding. I put this message in, and I get another message out of this, which is my encoded message. So then I have the encoded message, which is a sequence of symbols. This gets transmitted, and transmission might just mean writing it to a CD and reading it from the CD again or so. And in the transmission process, I get noise, which gets added to the message. So I now get I don't have the encoded, not just the encoded message, but I have the encoded message plus noise. And what I'll do is I'll feed this into a decoding process. And this decoding process should give me, well, I would hope, my original message back, if not too many errors would happen. And it can do this magic because The encoded message will be a little bit longer than the original message, and this redundancy will help us in correcting such errors. Okay. To do this encoding, or the method of encoding which I want to talk about here, uses a matrix. Okay. So what we do here, for the encoding, we use, let's suppose, we take k vectors, and we choose these vectors to be I want to choose these vectors to be vectors of length larger than k. And I want the length larger than k because that's what's going to introduce the redundancy of length larger than k. And I write them as rows in a so k vectors. Let's say these are g1 up to gk, and these are vectors with entries in the same field, and let's say they all have length l. So the length is L and is greater than K. Okay. So for example, and this is the first example I have here. Well, let's suppose my message would just consist of three symbols or of chunks of three symbols. I could choose. So now what I'll do is I will write these vectors G1 up to GK. Write the GI as rows of a matrix. And the reason that I write them as rows and not as columns is in part simply to make it easier when I type things that my matrices will be longer than high, and that is more convenient with how you normally type things down, that you don't have long objects there. But otherwise, and I can will write vectors as row vectors, so this just makes writing easier. So I write them as rows of a matrix. So for an example, I could choose k equals 3. Do I give a name to this matrix? This is called the generator matrix. And what I could do, for example, is I could just choose the following matrix, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1. Okay, and now the encoding process is simply the matrix product I take my sequence A1 up to AK. Let's give this a name. Let's call this G for generator matrix. So G is a K cross L matrix. And I just multiply this with the generator. Okay, so if I have this example, if this is my generator matrix, what would happen with the message which has the form ABC? Well, I just have to multiply ABC, the row vector ABC, with this matrix, and if I do this, what will happen? The first entry I get A, the second entry I get B, the third entry I get C,
And then the same thing repeats again, so it would be transmitted as ABC, ABC.
So the very naive way of redundance, by just repeating the message twice, can be represented in this way. Okay, clearly you wouldn't need such a fancy setup for this. This is just to motivate what this process does and to give you an idea that this is a very general scheme which one can use to do encoding. Okay, so one could do this, but this is not really that interesting. Let's look at another example. Let's suppose again I choose k equals 3. And let's suppose I choose for my generator matrix the following matrix. 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1. And if you look at the columns of this matrix, what I've simply done, how did I build this matrix? I basically wrote the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 in binary form. That's just how the columns of this matrix got created. Okay, so if this would be my generator matrix, then the message ABC would get encoded to the message A plus B, C, A plus C, B plus C, A plus B plus C, right? Just to see, why is the fourth one A plus C? Sorry, did I? No, what did I write here? A, comma B, comma, I forgot the B here. Why is the fifth one A plus C? Because the fifth column has an entry 1 for A and an entry 1 for C. If I had a minus 1 here, this would be A minus, right? So that's how this message gets encoded. Okay. Now, if I look at this, if I now look at all the possible results here, right? So the possible messages which I can encode, let's say I'm working over the field with two elements, my messages would be just 0 and 1s, then I can have two choices for A, B, and C each. So in total, I have 2 cubed, which is 8 possible messages, right? So if you take these, you get 8 possible encoded messages. And if you write them down, I haven't done this here, so you get 8 possible encoded messages. And if you look at these encoded messages, you will see that any two of these encoded messages differ in at least 3 places. Okay. So if they differ in at least 3 places, now suppose you take this encoded message, you send it in your transmission via some channel which puts on noise, and let's assume our noise level is just that high that we know there could be one error happen in the transmission. Of course, we need to make such assumptions about the number of errors. I mean, if we have a message of length 7 and 7 errors could occur, we can't guarantee anything anymore. So we assume, for example, by using tricks like this interleaving, which I mentioned before, that, or what we want to be able to deal with is the situation that one error would occur in the transmission of these 7 symbols. Okay. So now suppose we transmit this and this one error occurs. Okay. So we have our transmitted message here. The error occurs. One symbol is wrong. Okay. I know there are just 8 possible messages, right, which get translated here. So if I have an error, some symbol gets changed in the transmission, this message is not any of these 8 messages which they could be. But there is a closest message. And why is there a closest one? Because I said any two messages differ in at least 3 symbols. Okay. So If one symbol changes, that means there is a unique closest message. Right? If you have, if you would do this with words, let's suppose you would have just, two words. You have a word, let's say you have the word car and you have the word, the name Tom, say. Well, they differ. If you now, they differ in three positions, right? Now suppose you transmit one of them and one letter gets changed. So let's suppose instead of car, you hear cat. If you now compare cat with these two, you see cat agrees more with car than with Tom. So cat would be likely to have been the message car if these are the only two original messages, right? If I assume that only one error occurred. And that's the same situation here, just there my messages are longer and consist of zero and ones. Because any two encoded vectors, encoded messages, differ in at least three positions. So this is a code which can detect one error, if it happens, if one symbol gets wrong, and it can detect it basically also and can say, where did this error happen? We know what would be the correct answer. Okay. This would be called a one error correcting code. Well, those of you who had linear algebra will, of course, have noted already what I'm just doing is I'm forming linear combinations of these vectors. So my encoded messages basically form a vector space. And one could look at the, can look at codes also as vector spaces, but since I, this course doesn't assume that you had linear algebra, I don't really want to go much into details of this. Okay, so we can do this. How? We can correct one error here. However, the error correcting process was not, well, there are two things which are not that particularly satisfactory about this here. The first thing is we really have a big overhead. Our three symbol message now gets transmitted via seven symbols. So we have an overhead of more than two. In general, we would want a smaller overhead. The second thing, and this is something of very big practical relevance, is the question, how do we actually do the error correction? Here, the way I described the error correction, that I said, there are eight possible messages which can occur. We just look which one is closest. So the error correction here would work by going through the list of all possible messages and seeing which one is closest. And that is in practice not a very convenient process. So if we have something longer here, if we end up that we, let's suppose here we wouldn't have three symbols, we would have 10 symbols, then there would be already 1,024 different messages. And then having to go through this every time and see which one is closest would take very long. So decoding wouldn't really be practical in this process. So when you build codes, actually, one, there are two important aspects of building the code. The first thing is you want that your messages get map to something where all the possible encoded messages somehow differ in a lot of positions, and differing, the number of positions where they differ is called the Hamming distance. So you want that they differ in a lot of different positions so that you could correct a lot of errors. But what you also want is that your code somehow is produced in a very regular process, which would possibly let you determine where the error happened in an algorithmic way without having to go through all the messages. And indeed here, if you actually look at your last four, if you look at the last three columns, and probably this one here as well, but I think the last three are sufficient. You can actually figure out if you play around with it that there is a way how one can use this to determine where the error happened without having to check the total number of messages. So, and yeah, this is simply there so you can actually build a decoding device. So your decoding device does not need to have a library of all possible messages and check through this library. Okay. Yeah? Oh, because I have here my original message. It's the same number as the number of original messages, right? Every original message corresponds to one encoded message and vice versa. Why do I have 8 original messages? Because my original messages have 3 symbols and each symbol could be 0 or 1. So I have 2 times 2 times 2 possibilities and that's 8. No, these are not the encoded messages, right? My original messages consist of 3 symbols. The encoded message consists of 7 symbols. So the original message, for example, if my original message is 110, that gets encoded to, according to this scheme, 1, 1, if I work modulo over the field with 2 elements, 1 plus 1 is 0, C was 0, A plus C is 0, A plus C is 1, B plus C is 1, A plus B plus C is 0. So this message would be mapped to this 7 vector, element 7 entry vector. Or the message 0, 1, 1 would be mapped to 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0. Right? So that's what would happen in this transmission. My original 3 symbol message is made into a 7 symbol message, and I have 8 possible 3 symbol messages here, so I have 8 possible encoded 7 symbol messages. But there are many more total 7 symbol messages. There are 128 total 7 symbol messages, right? But just 8 of them, and that's the redundancy, but just 8 of them are in some way valid. So that's where I get my redundancy to be able to determine what errors happened and why they happened, or where errors happened. If you now compare these two here, they agree on, they differ in this position, this position, this position, and this position. So they differ in 4 positions. And if you try it for others and you try out all the possibilities, you will see they always differ in at least 3 positions. And that's something, at the moment I'm just saying, this is something you can observe. I haven't shown you, I haven't given you a reason why one would choose this. I've basically just pulled this out of a non-existing head. Okay. Right, so now I want to show you a scheme which one can use for building such codes. And what I want is, and this encoded thing, this is what I call a code word. This is the code word, which is the same as the encoded message. They're often called code words. Okay. To get some mechanism, in the hope to get some scheme which actually lets us decode easier, an assumption which has been made and has been made successful is to say we want that any cyclic shift of a code word, cyclic shift meaning I move all the symbols one to the right, say, and the last symbol back in the first position, that any such cyclic shift of a code word gives us again a code word. This is a certain regularity condition, and the hope is that the more regularity we put on, that we have get it behaving nicer and that we at some point know theory about describing these. So what I now do is, so this is my encoded message. This is this code word. And typically now I will describe this code word as C0, C1, C2, and so forth, up to, in this case, it's C7. That's my code word. Now I make the assumption that every cyclic shift of a code word is again a code word, and what I will do is I will associate to my code word C0, C1, up to, I said in general I have length L, so up to CL, I will associate a polynomial by just making these numbers to be the coefficients of the polynomial. So it's the polynomial c0 plus c1 times x plus c2 times x squared plus and so forth plus cl times x to the l. And why am I doing this? I'm doing this because a cyclic shift, what does a cyclic shift do? Let's say I shift 1 to the right. Then my code word becomes C0, C1 up to CL minus 1. And CL, the last one which gets moved out here, moves back in the first position. Right? So if I do this cyclic shift, in the polynomial world, I actually can represent this cyclic shift rather conveniently. I said L here. I just noticed I called this N. Sorry. So let me call this length N just so I'm consistent with what I have in the write-up here, CN. Okay. So the cyclic shift corresponds, if this is my polynomial P of X, by taking X times P of X, right? If I multiply with X, this becomes c0 times x plus c1 times x squared plus c2 times x cubed and so forth. The only thing I need to do, what do I do with the last term? How do I make I start at 0, so I want actually n minus 1. So I said L is equal to n minus 1. N minus 1, n minus 1. Okay, what happens with this last one here? If I multiply by x, this will be now c n minus 1 times x to the n. But I don't want an x to the n term here. I want at most an x to the n minus 1 term. And I want this really to sit in the first position, to be constant. So what I do, I can do this simply by taking this modulo x to the n minus 1. Right? Multiplying by x and taking it modulo x to the n minus 1 on polynomials does the same as right, as cyclic right shift does with these sequences. And the only reason for writing it this way is that we can now talk about polynomials where we have some theory where we can talk about it. Okay. Right. So my code words actually aren't polynomials. So the code words, they are not polynomials, but they live in, not in the polynomial ring, but they live in the polynomial ring, modulo the ideal generated by x to the n minus 1. And that's just saying, yes, I have the natural operation here is something taking it modulo x to the n minus 1. Okay, so that holds for all my code words. What do I know further about code words? If I add two code words, the sum is again a code word. The sum of two code words is a code word. And that's the case because this process of encoding is linear. Since I have any possible message, the sum, the component-wise sum of two messages is again a message because everything here is a possible message. So if I sum up the code words, since matrix multiplication is linear, since it preserves addition also, the sum of code words is again a code word. Okay. So if I look at the set of all possible code words, it lies in this quotient ring. And what I'm really doing here is I'm just looking at representatives in this quotient ring. It is closed under addition. And because I want that cyclic shifts are again code words. Cyclic shifts corresponded to multiplication by x or multiplication by ideal plus x in the quotient ring. So it's closed under multiplication by x, and therefore it's not hard to see that it basically is closed by multiplication with arbitrary elements because anything I can build from x. So it's also closed under multiplication by powers of x and sums of powers of x. So a product of code word with ideal plus polynomial is again a code word. So the set of code words is closed under addition and under multiplication by arbitrary elements. So the set of code words is what forms an ideal. Okay. Ideal plus x or plus polynomial in x. Yeah, so initially plus polynomial. Sorry, this reflects a little bit, but I don't think I can. I mean, if you want me to turn the light up or down, I'm happy to do so, but yeah, so this ideal plus polynomial, and initially it's just ideal plus x, and once I can do this from this, I can build polynomials. So the set of code words forms an ideal. Forms an ideal in the polynomial ring modulo the ideal generated by x to the n minus 1. Okay. Right, so my code, the set of all code words that is called the code, forms an ideal. And it forms an ideal in a quotient ring. In a very natural way here. And that's basically why I'm using this example here as illustration of it, because here we have a quotient ring, and now we have an ideal in a quotient ring, which initially looks like a rather scary object. What do we have there? Not only a quotient ring, but again, an ideal in there. But it comes up very naturally from the conditions which we impose there. And we will see later, because that this actually works well, and that therefore this is a reasonable approach of doing it. Okay, so now what can we tell about the ideals in this quotient ring? We know every such ideal is image of an ideal of this polynomial ring under the natural homomorphism. That's something which you're proving in the current homework, right? We talked about this on Monday. If we have the quotient ring, ideals in the quotient ring just correspond to ideals of the original ring, well, containing this one, containing x to the n minus 1. Of an ideal, well, let's give a name to this ideal. Let's say I call this ideal J, the ideal of f of x. Now, what can I tell about J? So I know that the ideal generated by x minus 1 is contained in J, and that is an ideal in the polynomial ring f of x. Well, we know, because we have the Euclidean algorithm, that in this polynomial ring, every ideal is a principal ideal, is generated by a single element. Right? So I know that this polynomial J must be generated by a single element. So I know that J must be generated by some single element. I will call it D of X. And why did I choose the letter D? D for divisor, because we've also seen that this single element actually must divide X to the n minus 1. If you want, D of X divides X to the n minus 1. Okay. Right. So, that's things we've done before, where we know this. This must be generated by a divisor of x to the n minus 1. Okay, And then what can I tell about the code? Then I know, then the code, which is just the set of code words, consists of, well, or consists of, or is, what is it? It is, I set an ideal in the quotient ring, and it's the ideal, it's the image of this principal ideal under the natural homomorphism, so it's the ideal generated by I plus D of X as an ideal in the polynomial ring modulo this ideal I, and I in this case is just the ideal generated by x to the n minus 1. Okay, so that's the set of code words in this interpretation. It's this ideal in the quotient ring. Okay. Right, so now I can describe this. If I go back to the, my, well, if I take the, what is this ideal? This consists of all the multiples of d of x, of our, or of I plus d of x, right? So if I now look at some elements in there. So, for example, I have elements in there. I have certainly I plus d of x in there. I have I plus x times d of x, I plus x squared times d of x, and so forth. These are, would be typical elements in this ideal, right? So now, what would be representatives? Representatives for these ideal elements would be, say, d of x, x times d of x, x square times d of x. Okay. And now I go back from representatives to row vectors. So, and let's write these row vectors in the generator matrix. Well, to write this, I need to say, what is my polynomial d of x? Let's suppose d of x is equal to d0 plus d1 times x plus d2 times x square plus and so forth. Up to what degree did I want to give it s? Up to ds x to the s. And so if I write, so what, sorry, what is, what do I get from this? I get d0, d1, d2, and so forth up to d to the s. Now, if I multiply with x, what happens there? Multiplication by x basically just meant a right shift. So I get here 0, d0, d1, and so forth. Here I get ds minus 1, and here I get ds, so I have a 0 here. And so forth. So the next row I get 0, 0, then a d0 here, then a d1 here, and so forth. So basically, this scheme just sits here like a parallelogram. I'm shifting in each new row, I'm shifting this set of numbers 1 to the right, and I pad at the end with zeros. So my last row just starts with zeros and then is d0 up to ds, and ds sits in the last position. That's the generator matrix for such a code. Okay. If you take engineering books, they typically don't assume that their readers have taken abstract algebra. They just tell you, for such a cyclic code, pick a polynomial d of x, which is a divisor of x to the n minus 1, and write its coefficient in a matrix in this scheme. So, yes, one can do this. One can say we just skip what we've done here and just take this matrix as given. But what we now understand, and that's why I went through this, is why we need to pick a polynomial which divides x to the n minus 1. That is to make this cyclically closed property, and we could deduce this by using quotient rings and actually using ideals and quotient rings. So we now understand why one could choose something like this. Okay. So for every divisor d of x to the n minus 1, I get such a cyclic code, I get such a generator matrix. And if you just try it out, again, we work possibly even over, we work over a finite field. If you try to factor x to the n minus 1, you will see it has tons of factors and therefore even more tons of divisors. Right? If it has three factors, you have, including 1/8 possible divisors, because you can choose every irreducible factor or not. So you have tons of divisors. So the question is, how can one choose these divisors to make a good code? And good, again, means two things. Well, or in some way three things. It means the code should give us good error correction, and encoding and decoding should be cheap to do. And cheap to do really means very concretely cheap to do. Think about not that you're doing this theoretically and you're thinking about it with long vectors in a vector space, but think about that you want to implement this in hardware, in electronics. So you really don't want to, you don't have much memory there. Certainly when they started doing this, this was for things like data transmission with space probes, when at times when the microchip was just invented or so. Or even if you look at what happened when CDs became introduced in the early 1980s. Oh, the scary thing is this is probably before you were born, right? Or, well, yeah, but many of you, for some, yeah. Anyhow, so at some, but there weren't always CDs. There was before something which were called vinyl records, and they could get scratched and could get broken and so forth. And when CDs were introduced, there really weren't, I mean, there were, yes, there were computers and there were some early home computers or so which existed, but certainly people didn't, the industry didn't have the capacity to just build devices which have really a small computer, fancy computer building. That was really at that point still that you would want to build it, that you really almost count the number of transistors or so for building a chip in a CD player. So we want a good decoding where we really can implement it in practice in a very easy way without having to, I mean, if we want to write down such a matrix, we need certainly storage for the matrix, and we need to implement something which does matrix multiplication or so. That's all very complicated. And if you think, oh, but nowadays we have these chips, the same problem still exists. It just exists on another level because people now want things like smart cards where you really have, where your object is just basically something like a credit card. And you just don't have much space to put a processor in. And you also don't have much power to put a processor in because these smart cards don't have a battery built in. You have this, you might have this on some credit cards, for example, they exist that they have these chips and they have some symbol here, which looks like the wireless network that you can put it on a reader. You don't need to swipe it. You just hold it over the reader. This card doesn't have a battery built in. What it just gets is when you hold it over the reader sends a small radio signal, and that's all the electricity the circuit in here has to do the processing. So you really can't do anything fancy there. You're really still working on the bare metal. Okay, so that's really why it's crucial to have the encoding and decoding working easily. Okay, so one particular way for getting such codes working well are so-called BCH codes. And they are named in honor of Bose, who was actually in his later life a professor here at CSU in the statistics department, Ray Chowdhury, think he has an H there. Chowdhury. Ray Chowdhury.
And a Frenchman, Hoquet. Hoquet-Gem, where I don't know anything about.
Chowdhury was professor at Ohio State. And they, yeah, they gave us something which are called BCH codes. And if you look, and BCH codes basically say, describe D by prescribing roots of this polynomial. Okay. At about the same time, or just a few years later, but I think initially without actually knowing initially about the work of both Chowdhury and Hoquet-Gem, two other people came up with a proposal which is basically a special case. This is a special case where the roots are particularly regular, and that, so a special case, this is a particular regularity of the roots. These are called Reed-Solomon codes. So this is a subclass of BCH codes, and Reed-Solomon codes are what is used in practice. That's what your CD player uses. That's what the hard disk in your computer uses. They are basically the standard working horse of these codes. And it, on the last page or last page and a quarter or so of the handout which I've given you, I've actually copied an article which was published a couple of years ago in the SIAM News. SIAM is a Society for Industrial and Applied Mathematics, which is basically just talking about the impact of these codes. So this is just some easy reading, which tells where they are all used. So this is a technology which is now in the industrialized Western world basically all around us. It's something I would almost bet that at least every other day or so, most of you use a device which somewhere internally uses such Reed-Solomon codes. And that's also something, if you take an electrical engineering book which talks in any way about digital data transmission, if you go in the index, you might even find BCH codes, you will certainly find Reed-Solomon codes. And if you take the engineering book, however, now they need to talk about some of such finite fields. Well, so first we say we want to prescribe roots. So if we just have the field with two elements, we just have two possible roots, and that's not that particularly interesting. So that means we really need to go to bigger fields. We need bigger finite fields. And as I told you before, that was one of the things which we wanted to do. We want to construct bigger finite fields. And we know how to do this. Quotients of polynomial rings by polynomials which can't be factored. We've seen they give us maximal ideals, because if they can't be factored, there can't be another ideal bigger. So the ideal is maximal, and we have seen ring modulo a maximal ideal, if you have a commutative ring with one, that gives us a field. Great. So we know how to build these fields. We know where they come from. The engineering book just says, oh, they come here as a small example, and I give you the multiplication table, and it comes rather ad hoc. So this is saying we certainly take bigger fields. In practice, if you take the CD, it is using a field with 256 elements. How did they construct it, this field? They just took a polynomial over the field with two elements of degree 8, which didn't have factors. It's not hard to find such a polynomial. Then you know the quotient will be a field with 256 elements. That's how they got that field. And now, if it has degree 256, however, now there are many possibilities to, we have 256 choices for roots, and therefore we can really choose more of these roots to build us such a code. Right. Another thing which we need to do is we need to look actually, we want our code to be error correct, right? So for this, we basically need the generate, we need to have redundance. That means the generator matrix must have more columns than rows, because otherwise we're actually losing some data there. So we can't just pick any arbitrary divisor. Also, if we would pick just x to the n as a divisor of itself, then basically we would just transmit a message to itself, map a message to itself. That's not very interesting to do. Right, so what I'm going to do next time is to tell you more about how these, some examples, how these Reed-Solomon codes are built, and then give you a concrete example how one can use them for encoding and decoding of messages. And this is an example which basically, apart from the language which I'm using about algebra, is an example which could be in an engineering textbook. Indeed, I have an engineering textbook where they have a very similar problem there, and they just don't use the algebra language. So this is really something which I think is of eminent practical relevance. Okay, thank you very much. Have a nice weekend, and I see you on Monday. Thank you.